Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show by deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition. And as I do, I'm looking at the gods, heroes, monsters, and other mythological beings that I find in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. Today's episode is an interlude, an inter-season episode. We finished up our section on the Indian mythos, if that's a term that we can use, which it isn't, and we have yet to begin our next season, which I can announce the poll results are in, and just narrowly, you have decided that we should focus on Hawaiian mythology. Obviously, this is something that is not in the Deities and Demigods book, so we're going to be taking a fresh look at it, seeing how it can be used in games. And of course, it's not something that I know all that much about. I mean, I know the basics, but we're going to be learning about it together in the same way that that we have been for some of these other pantheons. So I'm really looking forward to it. However, before then, we're going to do a couple episodes just returning to some of the other chapters of Deities and Demigods, the ones that focus on fictional pantheons or the ones that focus on literary rather than mythological characters, or, like here, ones that are specific to Dungeons & Dragons itself. We're going to be returning to the non-human deities chapter. Now, it has been a long time since we've done one of these non-human deities episodes, and to be 100% honest with you, there are some where I'm not sure whether I've done them already. I've been through the past episodes, and as far as I can tell, from the non-human deities chapter, we have already covered Hrugek, the bugbear god of battles, Corlan Larithian, the sort of supreme deity of the elven pantheon, Rilifane Ralithil, the elven god of woods and things, and therefore god of the wood elves, Kurtulmak, the god of kobolds, Blibdulpoop, the goddess of Kuotoa, Semuanya, the god of lizardmen, Idro, god of Lokotha and mermen, and basically just kind of a sea god, Grumsh, the god of orcs, and Laugzed, the chief god of troglodytes. And coming to that, I feel like we must have done Maglubiet, the god of goblins, but I can't find the episode in which that happened. And if you've listened to my previous episodes in which I talked about these non-human deities, you will find that I am not the biggest fan of them in general. And the problem is that a lot of them suffer from a version of the Welcome to Westeros problem. If you read George R.R. Martin's Song of Ice and Fire books, you'll know that different parts of the setting suffer a little bit from being kind of over-themed. You know, you arrive in Fishtown and everybody's like, "Welcome to Fishtown. I'm Bill the Sailor. This is my wife, Jane the Sailor. Our king sits in Salt Rock's castle and he sits upon the driftwood chair and, you know, tridents and mermen. And did I mention that our town is on the ocean?" And I understand why this is, right? If you're telling a sprawling epic that covers a wide range of different locations, a wide range of different characters, many of whom may not be on the page for all that long, having them be sort of stereotyped and exaggerated is a way of making them memorable, of making it possible for the reader to keep track of all these different factions and all these different locations by associating them with very distinctive, you know, maybe kind of oversimplified themes and aesthetics. The downside is that, you know, it's pretty boring. It's doubly the case when you are doing it twice, which is basically what's happening here, right? Hrugek is a big, tough bugbear, and he fights and defeats other powerful beings or deities or whatever, and he lives in a cave, and he has a club, and he is just only the characterization that you'd think of from an especially bugbear-y bugbear. And what's really weird is that Hrugek is only one of six deities within the bugbear pantheon, and the others maybe sound a little bit more kind of off-brand. Like, they sound a little bit more varied, but Hrugek has been chosen here, presumably because he is the most representative. I don't know. That's assuming that the others exist at all, rather than just having been casually dropped in this one sentence. So maybe I should say Hrugek has been created because he is representative of bugbears. But is that actually what we want out of deities? Like, take Moradin the Soulforger, who is kind of the primary god of the dwarven pantheon, although not the only one. I swear I've talked about Moradin before. I can't find an episode that I did it in, but I must have done. Moradin is exactly what you would come up with on the first try. If I said, "Hey, create a deity for dwarves in a fantasy setting," you would be like, okay, he's a smith god and he forged them out of mithril and steel and You know, he clangs away at his mighty forge deep underground. There are a couple of neat little details. So, for example, we learned that dwarf souls entered their bodies when Moradin breathed on them to cool them. That's kind of a fun image. And there's a description of a shrine to Moradin, which is that it has like a big forge in the center. So when the faithful bring offerings, the clergy like put them in there and melt them down to make things out of them. So that's kind of fun. Like if you were given a magic item by the priests of Moradin, like it could be something that was made out of all the different donations that all the dwarves in your big dwarven city had given to them. That's sort of a, you know, a fun thought, but that's just about it. And this essentially misunderstands the role that gods play in polytheistic or even monotheistic societies. It kind of doesn't either make sense as a religion or tell as much as a piece of characterization, because while Moradin's, like, temperament, you know, gruff and practical, and his interests, you know, smithing and metalwork, align with what we knew about dwarves, they don't extend beyond or provide new perspective on what we already knew about dwarves. They're just exactly what you would expect. It's as if you made a culture based on England, and it had like a god of tea, and a god of absurd humor, and a god of waiting in lines, and a god, excuse me, cues, and a god of complaining. It doesn't provide any more characterization for people who are looking at the culture from the outside, because it just matches what you already knew. And it doesn't provide any conflict or motivation from people who are on the inside. Right? If you were playing a dwarf, Moradin doesn't add anything, you know, doesn't add any commandments that you have to obey that you might otherwise not obey. It just supports that model of characterization where characterization is, oh, I rigidly adhere to certain rules, and if I follow those rules, then I am well characterized. But in real life, and in good literature, religion is the source of conflict. That I have commandments or principles that I should follow that may conflict with what I need in the moment. Now, what's interesting about the entries in these fictional deities is that they resemble the ones for historical deities, but they're lacking the context that the fact that those deities are historical gives them. So I don't need Jim Ward to tell me what Zeus's deal is. I know what Zeus's deal is, and I venture to suggest that everyone knows what Zeus's deal is, or if they don't, they can just, you know, go to the public library and get out a book on Greek mythology. There are barriers in some cases, but I would say that for the most part, for people who have access to Dungeons & Dragons books, it is easier to get access to a book on Greek mythology than it is a D&D book for almost everyone. But that's not true for Laugzed or whatever. All I have to go on when I think about Laugzed is what's here in Deities and Demigods. And I mean, actually, Laugzed's pretty cool. But for Semuanya or whatever, all I have to go on is what's in this chapter, and that isn't very much. I am being perhaps a little unfair in picking out the blander examples of these deities. So I don't know if we've done Deep Sashalas, the god of the elves, aquatic, but he has got some kind of interesting features, actually. I like him a bit. And that's good because the elves, aquatic are a bit of a blank slate. Like, we don't really know all that much about them, and I don't feel a compelling sense of their, like, gimmick. I mean, is that they live in the water, but that doesn't feel like enough to me. So Deep Sashalas is described as the knowledgeable one. He's a god who's full of information about the ocean and its contents. And, you know, he knows where the fish are biting and he knows where the dangerous currents are. And so the elves venerate him for this knowledge. And he's also worshipped by people who aren't elves, aquatic, right? Like, human or other sailors will pray to Deep Sashalas for his knowledge of the oceans. He's associated with dolphins and is therefore opposed to sharks. And it says they'll even engage in shark hunts. This is really weird. You know, is it just that it was the 70s thing? So, because we've seen a few times this idea that dolphins and sharks are deadly enemies, and that is because sharks are evil, but dolphins are good. Sharks are associated with evil gods, as we'll see in a moment. Dolphins are associated with good gods like Deep Sashalas. And we often have a specific opposition between Sahuagin, who are associated with sharks, and other aquatic species, in this case the elves, aquatic, who are associated with dolphins. We saw that in Monstrous Manual. I understand that the idea of an evil shark is like a common image in pop culture. Like, if you have a team of animal heroes, like Brute Force or whatever, then the good version of the team will have a dolphin on it, and the evil version of the team will have a shark on it. But they're both just aquatic predators. Dolphins don't bite people, I guess, but the vast majority of shark species aren't dangerous to humans. And even the ones that are actually attack humans very rarely. You know, there's not like a bit in the monster manual suggesting that, you know, bears or mountain lions are evil, but they're also dangerous to humans, or can be. Now, having said that, I went back and looked at the alignments of sharks and dolphins in the monster manual. And sharks are neutral, right? Just most animals have neutral alignment, right? They obviously don't really have moral agency, so it would be weird to give them an alignment. But dolphins have an alignment. They are lawful good. To me, this reflects a lack of familiarity with dolphin behavior. Is it just because of Jaws? I think Jaws was very much in the zeitgeist at this time. It comes out in, what, like 1975? So, you know, it would be a recent watch for a lot of people here, in the same way that, like, Call of Cthulhu as a play culture was very influenced by the fact that Raiders of the Lost Ark came out earlier the year that Call of Cthulhu came out. Speaking of sharks, the Sahuagin worship Sekola, who is basically just the bad sea god, represented as a giant, ever-hungry white shark. There's a couple of good bits in the Sekola description. I like the idea that he swims in the deepest seas of the nine hells, preying on whatever is down there, which we have to assume is, you know, whatever's down there is pretty gnarly. So that's kind of cool. There is a rite where the Sahuagin sacrifice what they perceive as like the useless members of their society, so the aged and the sick and the weak, to Sekola by feeding them to the holy sharks that accompany Sahuagin clerics. Now, this is interesting. I went back and looked at the Sahuagin entry in the monster manual to see to what extent this was different from what we had already seen. And what's interesting is that it is kind of like it's a refinement of the existing Sahuagin entry. So the Sahuagin entry does have this thing about how Sahuagin are merciless creeps who kill people, and or Sahuagin, that they feel like don't live up to their standards or whatever, but and eat them. You know, the idea being that at least they will be of some use to the Sahuagin. And this is not associated with the worship of their god or with their priesthood, although there is a good deal of discussion of their, like, religious structure. It then goes on to say that, like, this is a cruel practice, but it has bred the Sahuagin into a strong and merciless opponent. Which actually sounds like BS to me, but I understand why it's a, like, stock piece of villain characterization. But realistically, you know, if I were in one of these Sahuagin raiding parties and I knew that if I got wounded, my comrades would leave me behind or cut my throat and eat me, I would tend to fight more cautiously rather than more aggressively, because I would know that I had only myself to rely upon, and keeping myself safe would become a higher priority. This is one of the reasons that you get this kind of like no man left behind attitude in real world militaries. Like, I have no idea how historically accurate it is, but if you watch Black Hawk Down, like, they're always getting in trouble because the convoy will be driving along, somebody will get wounded, they'll stop to like make sure that person's okay and get him in the thing, during which time more people get wounded, etc. So you'd think at a tactical level that seems like a bad idea, but as a broader principle of improving people's morale because they realize that they're not going to be abandoned, you have to think that it has positive effects overall. You can't trust a Sahuagin even if you're another Sahuagin, which has got to lead to, like, a lack of unit cohesion. What this reminded me of, though, while I was at it, is that the Sahuagin entry is one of the longest entries in the monster manual. I mean, it may be the longest for a monster of that type. It's like the entire first page of the S chapter. And when you think about how short the monster manual entries are, that's very long. You know, that's the length of an ordinary entry in Monsters Manual, but it's extremely long by 1977 standards. So it's an interesting instance of how the religion section can do a little bit of world building. And I wonder if the difference is that Sahuagin are, you know, obviously derived from a number of other fish people, you know, fictional exemplars, right? They're the sea devils from Doctor Who, or they're the deep ones or whatever. In fact, they're even called sea devils, right? But they are not bound to any kind of other, you know, they're not like giants or something. They're not attached to some kind of well-known folkloric tradition. And did the creators therefore feel that they had a more like open hand, try little world building? Like, you maybe you don't think you can make Grolantor, the god of hill giants, much more than the hilliest hill giant you can imagine, basically a sort of divine bully. But you can do more with Sahuagin because, you know, if you want to make sure that something is okay to use the Sahuagin or not, like, they were created by someone where you can just, like, stick your head out of your office and yell down the corridor. I mean, I actually don't know that much about the textual history of Sahuagin, so if they're, you know, created by somebody who's not at TSR in, you know, the late 70s when this book's being written. Also, from the description of how he wrote this book, you know, Jim Ward's not sitting in an office at TSR. He's at home in Iowa or wherever. But, you know, never mind all that. The point is that maybe you don't feel an obligation to the existing lore, or at least you feel like you have the ability to add to it rather than just a responsibility to reflect it. Mind you, you know, I said that Grolantor may not be that interesting because the authors may have felt a compulsion to just, like, color within the lines, you know, to keep their hill giant within the bounds of what a hill giant could mean. But actually, the stone giant god, Scorias Stonebones, if that's what he's called, Scorias anyway, is pretty interesting. He's like a giant stone god who sits at the center of the earth and hears all that occurs because he can sense the vibrations through, like, the earth's crust. That's really cool. That is much more like an actual deity than all of these just kind of like, oh, what's Grolantor like? Well, he's the biggest hill giant and he believes that you should bully everyone beneath you. Oh, so he just believes you should do what hill giants already do? Cool, cool, cool. Scorias is kind of weird, and you can imagine that, like, if you met a bunch of stone giants and asked them about their faith, you wouldn't be able to fully understand it and its role in their society in less than a minute, which you could definitely do with Grolantor, because Grolantor is a stupid god for stupid monsters, but also just kind of simplistic in the first place. I guess, you know, this is interesting because I started to write in my notes that I think this is symptomatic of mature D&D characterization, but this isn't really mature D&D, right? We're still in the first decade here, which is kind of what I think of as quote-unquote early D&D. You know, we're still at the point where we're not just like, we're not really footnoting earlier stuff. This might be like a first example of it, really. This and the Fiend Folio are commenting on an existing AD&D like corpus of texts and a play culture. But mostly this isn't even like useful building blocks. So, like I said, I like the thing about Moradin breathing souls into dwarves as he blew on them to cool them. That's a very cool image, but I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it in game. It doesn't inform how dwarves ought to behave. It doesn't provide a conflict between how dwarves want to behave and what their religion tells them. It doesn't illuminate anything about dwarven society. It's a nicely observed detail, but beyond that, there's not much to it. You know, where at least when I look at like Laugzed or Sekola, the bad guy deities, I get some descriptions of the kind of rites by which they are worshipped, which is cool because it's absolutely like you can imagine, you know, sneaking into the troglodyte cavern while they're all shedding their skins in honor of Laugzed, or crouching behind the rocks in a big sea cave where the Sahuagin are getting ready to throw some poor, helpless, like Sahuagin grandmas to circling holy sharks, and some absolute loon of a Sahuagin priestess is just serenely floating in the midst of all these circling man-eaters and the water bloody bubbling. Great. Fantastic imagery, right? Temple of the Shark God. Classic pulp adventure stuff. You know, maybe not the most creative, maybe not the most, like, completely new, but good meat and potatoes pulp adventure writing. Fine. But I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this Moradin stuff. It's nothing. It's just filigree. If this was in a novel, I could understand it, maybe. It wouldn't be a huge amount of fun. But what it feels like is in a video game when you mouse over an object, like, you know, you see a hammer lying on the ground and you click on it, it's like, ancient dwarven hammer, bashing, +4. It is said that the smith god Moradin, I'm like, that's cool. But is there only really to, like, intrigue completists? And because it's only for completists, it has to be kind of irrelevant. Which is not to criticize the authors for producing something that's less compelling than real mythology, right? I'm not saying like, psh, Jim Ward, how dare you not come up with something that was as good as actual mythology that developed over centuries or millennia and has inspired all this great art by all these different people. Obviously, that wasn't going to be the case. But I do think that at this early point, there is maybe a feeling that this stuff should be detailed, but not a very clear vision of how that detail would come up at the game table. And I do think that in the 80s, we're going to start to see a transition into D&D being played in a different way, where the idea of campaign and narratives begin to emerge, and this kind of information will be seen as necessarily relevant. I don't know. Or maybe it's just like the pose of TSR as like a font of authoritative information is going to be important. And as we saw in, when I think, this is perhaps a digression, when I think about the Monsters Manual, I think about, there's a scene, is it in the Crucible? The guy comes in with like all his Bibles and like commentaries and like witch hunting manuals, and he thumps them down on the table, and someone says, heavy books. And he goes, yes, they are weighted with authority. I feel like there was a sense in kind of like mature period TSR where the fact that they were producing, you know, an issue of Dragon Magazine every month and all of these like big chunkety books and all these novels and et cetera, et cetera. You know, it feels a little bit like how Games Workshop feels in the 2020s. That just this constant fire hose of material is meant to make the thing seem real and authoritative. Like if you wanted to learn about medieval England, there would be textbooks and there would be source books and there would be archaeological reports and there would be museum catalogs and there would be, you know, primary sources in translation and everything. There would be stacks upon stacks upon stacks of text, even for an era where, like, you know, we maybe don't have as much raw data. My point is simply that sometimes having a lot of words about something can make it feel comfortingly authoritative. And I wonder if we're starting to see the first tentative steps in that direction. I wouldn't care to stand by that comment. That's just a thought. And I know the temptation to write the most obvious thing. As I am writing the thing that I'm writing now, I constantly feel this worry like, oh, what if the reader doesn't get what I'm trying to say? What that leads to is hammering the point home, even though the majority of readers will perfectly well understand what it is I'm trying to say. And what you have to learn to do is say, okay, what if the reader doesn't get what I'm trying to convey with this character? Would that be so bad? And the answer is typically no. So, you know, I'm trying to write with a lighter touch, which is hard. It is hard. And I understand the temptation to kind of like, well, what if we just say it again to really drive the point home? You have to not do it, but it's understandable why people do. All right, now that really is about all the time that I have for today to talk about non-human deities. In our next episode of Patron Deities, I think maybe we'll return to the Arthurian, or maybe we'll take a look at some of that Fritz Leiber stuff that's in here. I haven't decided yet, but I want to spend a little more time among the kind of lesser, if you will, deities and demigods chapters before we, or as I prepare to, jump in to our section on Hawaiian mythology. But I'm really looking forward to that. I think you're going to enjoy it. And I think we're all, especially me, going to learn a lot. And, you know, learn a lot about some cultures and mythologies that if you're me, you're maybe not that familiar with. I hope that you'll stick around for more of Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening. And thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.